I hope this was understandable. And
Well, welcome everyone again. The party is well known for its ability to debate issues, and in its time it's come up against people that have very different views to what the party has. So today we've got people that have been in the party for a long time and people that are sort of coming new to the party and having a look, seeing what they think about it. So I'll be asking people, you know, if they want to ask a question, etc., etc. But if members of the party disagree with the opinion of someone, it's their opinion they disagree with and not the person. I think that's, you know, that's got to be very sort of understood and valid. So would anyone like to start? Carla?
With the Strugazzi brothers, you were talking about the method of administration, okay. Does he talk about how this is done? You know, it's not an elite, you said. So how are they elected? What happens? Is this explained in the book?
In the books, very little is explained because the books are fiction. So they focus on the story. They focus on characters and so what happens there, basically. So it's not one of those utopias where the main thing that the author is trying to do is to depict the new, to make, you know, explain the new society. There are many of utopias like this, and they are often presented in a dialogue. So there is a person who asks, so how do you do that? Well, we do this and this and this and that. Okay, but I don't understand. How do you do this? Well, this is how we do it. This is to really present, okay, this is a new society, that that's not what these books are about. So a lot of these things we have to infer. We have to indirectly try to guess how it is. No, it's not explained. It does not say anything about them being elected. So when you look at, so I've mentioned it once, there are these councils made of professionals, scientists, and so on. I would guess, again, this is just my personal guess, it's done very similarly to how it's done in the institution of science currently. Scientists are not chosen, they're not democratically chosen. Okay, you will be studying this and that, and you are the biggest specialist on this and that. They just know the stuff, so they do it. And very few of them are very rich. So they're not mostly doing it for the money. They also need to survive, and in current capitalist system, very few of us can escape of that capitalist drive. So a lot of things we do because of money. But still, I would say that system works quite nicely in the way that capacity is recognized. And it has to be proven over and over again. If somebody else comes in and says, well, no, the theory that you put here is actually wrong, and I can prove it, da-da-da-da-da. That person is not going to be in a, well, leading, I don't want to say leading, but in a more professional position anymore. They will be replaced by someone else who knows better. Now, why this is important? Because that's why I presented hierarchy versus capacity. Because these people don't violate others' will. They don't coerce other people. They don't make them do something. And there's no proprietary thing there. So they don't own anything. But if I want to know, coming back to the topic, my favorite, of EVs or electric cars, whatever, if I want to know how to get somewhere in a society, I don't want to decide whether it is an EV or a tram or a patrol car or an airplane. What I want is to get somewhere comfortably, conveniently, and fast. This I have the right. I want to. Now, somebody else who knows this stuff will be able to tell how to organize our society in the way that we all get this, that we can get to places conveniently, comfortably, and quickly, and not ruining the environment. But I don't know how to do it. And I don't want to be asked what kind of transportation I want. I only want to get there. That's all. So from this point of view, specialists are especially deciding their own little area of expertise. They're not elite. They just know that stuff. They're not deciding things about other things. And it is, I think, possible to separate things that we do in the society into these little silos, where things who are specialists decide how to do it better. I hope that answers the question.
Mike, and then Howard.
Thank you, that was very interesting and very well put together with all the slides, and I haven't heard of the authors before you mentioned them. I was just wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit more about how their work has been sort of received in Russia, in terms of sort of popularity. I guess it's quite popular because they're able to publish a series of books. So I wonder what sort of influence they had, especially if what they were writing about did inspire anyone sort of on a political level rather than just on a sort of a literary or artistic level. And if there was, you mentioned that they had to be careful of Soviet censorship. I was wondering how much of an issue that was for them, if they had to write things in a certain way, or you know, leave certain things out, or to avoid having pressure from the elite. So yeah, I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how their work was sort of received.
Sure.
In Russia at the time.
So they started writing in the end of 60s, or maybe beginning of 60s, I'm not exactly sure, but in the 60s. They were very well perceived as quite intelligent authors who came up with interesting stories. And I think in the beginning of 70s, they published a couple of books that just went viral. They were wildly popular. And this was a thing in the Soviet Union. And not, I haven't heard an explanation why exactly it was a thing that the party, well, the by default government or people who decide, just didn't want anyone to be wildly popular. So once somebody became too popular in their opinion, they would be shut down. So that's exactly what happened to Strugatsky. Suddenly, they were told, well, we don't want to publish you anymore. Yes, you can publish that book, maybe, I don't know, 2,000-3,000 copies. But that's about it. So throughout, I think from the middle of 70s to the middle of 80s, it was impossible to get their books. They kept writing, but it wasn't available. So people would use typewriters to make copies and just distribute them, the so-called samizdat, which means self-publishing, self-printing. But you could only make one copy on your typewriter. So this was the way how it was spread. And then after 1985, 1986, you know, the thawing and the more Gorbachev time when Soviet Union started opening up, then their books were finally given to people and they became really, really popular. And I think to this time they are considered the best of the sci-fi. I don't think they have inspired any political movement. There is this whole topic of Soviet Union is very, very controversial in Russia still, because there are some people who say, we want to go back, we love Soviet Union. And other people say, really? And so it's quite polarized. So basically, I would say people who like Strugatsky, they're being very careful, because on the one hand, they are sort of saying, well, there were some things in the Soviet Union that are worth retaining. Maybe we shouldn't throw out the whole thing simply because it was state capitalism. Maybe some things there actually work better than what we have now. But other people just, you know, start talking about Stalin, who drank blood of virgins and newborns, and that's it. That's the end of the story, the end of the conversation.
You partly answered the question I was going to ask, actually. And my question was, shouldn't we feel a little bit uneasy about these depictions of a future society which are being put forward within the Soviet Union, because after all, the Soviet Union always said that the socialism that existed there was an early stage, and that later on things would be better, and eventually there'd be full communism in the sort of, Marxist style. Now, we know that was never going to happen. State capitalism was state capitalism, it wasn't going to lead to socialism. But the thought that came into my mind was that wasn't this a sort of, if you like, subtle form of propaganda, a way of the Soviet state allowed this because it furthered this sort of myth that eventually Soviet system would lead to socialism, as it were, to a much better society. And what sort of prompted that thought as well were those illustrations that you showed, which seemed to me to be a sort of some form of, stilted Soviet propaganda, the way they were formulated. This is the perfect society, we're on our way there, we'll get there in the end, and it's worth reading these books for that reason. These books show what's going to happen. Now, you just said that it wasn't like that, in the sense that they were sort of, to a certain extent, suppressed by the Soviet regime. And in fact, they became more popular after the Soviet regime fell. So that's why I say that, to a certain extent, you've answered my question, but, the fact that these books were allowed to be published at all, couldn't that be seen, nevertheless, as a form of, the regime trying to sort of, further the myth that eventually they'd get to what they used to call full communism?
Yes. So I understand the question. To me personally, there's no problem per se, because I don't associate the Noon Universe and the Soviet Union. I can understand how maybe for some people who start thinking about it without having read the books, they might kind of fall into this thinking. But unless you actually consciously try to put them together, I don't think they should come together. In my mind, they never really... I've never associated them. First of all, like you said, they were suppressed. Not in a way, they were really suppressed. Immediately after the party understood that it's not going where they want, they stopped them. Then there is quite a lot of criticism of their... criticism, as I mean literary criticism, not criticizing the books of their work. And critics show how there is actually the development of their own opinion of the Soviet Union and of the whole system, which came from starting from, yay, let's build this wonderful, beautiful future, to, is it really going to work? To, but you have promised that communism would be built by now, to, hold on a second, that is BS. That's not what you promised us. To complete disillusionment. So the later, in even the latest works, one of them died earlier, but the second one continued writing in the 90s. There were some works written in the 90s that show complete disillusionment. It's actually painful to read those books, because you can feel that they are disheartened by this. The idea sort of went, I don't subscribe to this, but I don't agree with them. I don't think we should put everything together and say, well, this is our one whole big idea. Soviet Union, Noon Universe, Strugatsky, all that thing. No, thank you, goodbye. No, why do that? Why can't we really systematically divide, separate, and see this is useful. We're going to retain it. This, no, thank you. We don't need that. I think this is a more productive approach. So yes, in a way there is danger, but only there is danger if you put them together. Unless you do that, I don't think there is danger at all.
Okay, thanks.
I'll just refer to something Glenn said this morning about beauty, and where I can see that architecture, furniture making will be beautiful in a socialist society. What about the written word? I mean, fiction, for example. What will fiction be about?
I think actually Strugatsky is the answer to that. Why? Because their own fiction, like I said previously, it's mainly fiction. It's not this kind of utopias that explains stuff. It's mainly about the story, and it's mainly about people. It has brilliant language. I think the English translations don't do justice to the original. It's very, very well written. And this is their strongest feature, not the other stuff. That's the best part of Strugatsky books. The ideas that they describe. So the beauty, not only in the language, but beauty in ideas, beauty in depiction of real people, the real realistic relationships, how people develop and so on. So I think this kind of literature is the kind of literature we need in a socialist world.
It's been written once. It's not never written again, is it?
It's just an example.
Yeah. I'm saying, what will all the rest of the literature be about?
Well, literature is always depicting problems that people have. It helps us develop. Okay. So it depends on the people of this in the socialist society. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. What kind of people will be?
I didn't mean that.
Yes.
In my mind, I think if we have a perfect society, let's say, for want of a better description, a perfect society, most of the literature, the books, fiction, etc., we read is about divorce, about war, whatever. You know, it's usually pretty dark stuff. If we've got a society where things are relatively good, what are we going to write about?
This is actually a very good question, I think, because it's related directly to what I said, that this vision is more appealing to me as a more dynamic world, as a world in progress, as a world that's going somewhere. Now, if you ask, so where is it going? To me, a big part of it is learning. Learning about the world, learning of people about themselves. There's so much we still don't know. We know more about Mars than we know about our own oceans. There's so much to learn. There's so much to learn about our own brain, our own psychology, how we interact, just understanding ourselves, how we function. This, and also how to organize and this is the society better. So if this is a sort of good society, it doesn't mean it's the best. People from, I don't know, 17th century might look at us now and think, wow, these people live in luxury. There's nothing else they need. But we say, sorry, no, not acceptable. So I'm sure in this dynamic society, people will have problems. For example, in their books, they describe this is really kind of a high level maybe, but they describe problems of trying to progress other societies that are not at their level. So one of the biggest problems there is, what if those societies don't want to progress? Do we have the moral right to force them to progress? What if they insist on being sort of on a lower level? So this kind of problems, this kind of, there's a lot of problems that can be discussed in socialist literature.
Thank you.
Bill?
Just two points, I guess. Interesting because I only recently discovered Soviet science fiction in English translation. I can't remember the name of the author, just finished one called Andromeda Nebula.
Yeah.
Which, I guess, is similar, I think, to what you're describing with
Yefremov,
Gatsby Brothers. I wasn't sure if the translation was that brilliant. Sometimes it feels a bit ropey. But that one, again, you have characters who, you know, he has something going on in his personal life, so he rings up the Labour Bureau and says, I want some really hard work, please. gets himself set to some lines, you know, because he just feels like he needs something to be doing for a few months. But again, I was reading and thinking this felt like it was slotting in, and it must have been getting past official propaganda and censorship to get there. But appreciating at the same time, it did, compared to, say, you know, American science fiction of the same period, it seemed to be putting forward a very positive view of progress, the world, and everything like that, which I thought was quite attractive. but similar to Howard's point, it's just I do wonder if utopia, it has this kind of double edge, in as much as over here, a lot of Labour politicians to the left of the Labour Party will have read News from Nowhere and could probably cite it and will probably have said, well, you know, once upon a time you'd have had the Labour Party saying, yes, socialism is the goal eventually, but for now, we've got to do what we're doing, and you know, we've got to run capitalism. The utopian element was a support for the actual maintenance of the status quo, rather than being a something to push things forward. And it's a bit like Zizek's idea of disidentification. We've got this, you know, he says that MASH is fundamentally a pro-war movement. You've got all these characters who hate the war, they all say how much they hate the war, but in reality, they're all doing their best to patch soldiers up and send them back off to fight. So no matter how much you disidentify with the actual resistance state of things, in fact, it just keeps the status quo going a bit longer.
Yeah, there's always a danger. So many things can be perceived as tools towards achieving a goal. You know, a hammer is a wonderful tool, and many capitalists use hammers. Should we not use hammers then? You know, again, separating this, trying not to lump everything together and saying, hey, just because this is something that's being done badly by bad people, we should never even touch it. You know, I think separating really helps. Being more pragmatic about it.
Voice from the crowd somewhere? No, nobody want to ask the question? Okay, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, that was absolutely superb. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
First, really interesting listening. And I think we were talking about maybe, you know, taking one step forward and what science fiction might look in the future. And we think back to the early days of Tomorrow's World and Star Trek, for example, and all the innovations that seemed only a sort of far-flung sort of vision of the future, how so much of it has become reality. You think back to the original flip phones that were so similar, mobile phones, to what they used in Star Trek, and how, you know, we've progressed from then to where we are now, whereas at the time it just seemed unreal. You know, speaking to each other face to face on opposite sides of the world through Discord and all these things, you're talking to your computers and getting a reply in the form of Alexa, all that has become a reality. The one thing, of course, that hasn't become a reality is being able to sort of beam ourselves up and down from place to place, which would be a nice form of science fiction to keep working on until that becomes a reality. And I think it's also helpful to take little bits of things and piece them together. You know, there are elements of what's, and of course, having to do the interpretation, where you can take little bits of, you know, a little bit of what you like and what you like. You know, there are ideas that become ideology that eventually become a reality. And, you know, taking little bits and pieces of what might appear to be utopian now, if that's what we aspire to and that's what we like to aim for, then all well and good. You know, we don't have to paint this rosy kind of picture that people are just not going to believe. Instead, we have to be realistic enough to know what is achievable as human beings, and eventually we get there with joined up working and cooperation. And I think as a party we do that pretty well ourselves, you know, as a collective. You know, in terms of, there are people who have different expertises and different sort of skills and qualifications, and we can come together in its form sense through the whole kind of point of electing each other to become representative executive committee members and various other committees. But just recently, a whole sort of new sort of ad hoc informal committee has sprung up, where there are about a dozen is now all working towards and the rest towards preparing for the COP26 conference in Glasgow, where each of us come together once a month, and everyone's invited, by the way, to chip in and say their piece. We've got experts on graphics, we've got experts in general organisational skills and experts in all sorts of things. And we come together and we share ideas, and slowly but surely we're getting to a point, it's like a little microcosm of what you would maybe expect future society to be, where we're not hierarchical in any way. We respect and others, you know, ideas and suggestions, and we bounce them around. A little bit time consuming, admittedly, But that's when you get the best results and you get the best out of people. And I think as a party, we're actually pretty good at doing that, of finding our own little niches and our own little specialities. And if someone can suggest something better and we're in agreement with it, we respect that too, yeah. You know. Yeah. And I think that's very much a good example, even just that little example of how hopefully a socialist society will develop, you know. We're basically getting the best out of each other, for each other.
Yeah.
And a lot of these science fiction, and if we maybe see the film from the 70s, the original series of Star Trek, there are some good examples in there of it. A lot of it pretty fantastical and fantasy, and a lot of it propaganda as well, you know, the wonderfully peaceful West and the evil sort of East portrayed as alien beings and such like. Purely for propaganda, but I'm sure as socialists we'll be able to relate and identify with that in many ways. But certainly some good stuff out there in the past and in the present, making way for hopefully a much better, productive and cooperative future. Yeah, that's all I have to say. Cheers.
Thank you.
Roy, did you want to speak? No? Right. Paddy?
Yeah, I just like to try and answer Joy's question, because I think I've often wondered this about, you know, what would entertainment look like, what would cinemas look like, what field would, you know, what would people read. Now, it occurs to me that one of the clues to the issues that would be kind of worthy of novels in a socialist society. It relates to what Leon said about, you know, literature. What is literature for? It's about learning. It's about what, you know, young people learning about life, about, you know, the virtue of having the right values and not the wrong ones. But it's also, literature is also about holding up your mirrors in your own society. So it's all those things. So that would be true in socialism as well. Now, why we can't see it now is because our picture is so hideously distorted by capitalism. Can't see past that. It's like a prism, so, you know, it just bends the light, so you can't see through it. But one of the clues, what it would be like, maybe, I think, is actually in Dispossessed. Now, if anybody remembers what the reason why the main character, he's a young scientist, and the reason why he leaves the moon Anaris and goes to the capitalist Uras is because he finds that he's struggling under the oppressive weight of an institutional scientific system, where which is science by which is eminence-based science, and he goes to the capitalist Uras for the real opportunity for evidence-based science, because they don't care; they only care about making money, so they don't have this kind of oppressive eminence-based system. And now it occurs to me. What does that imply for socialism? Maybe nothing, because Ursula Le Guin was just making that up, of course, it's a story. What it could imply, I think, is that the dynamic of socialist society would be completely different from what it is in other capitalism. And I don't know if it's the second law or the third law of thermodynamics, it's the one to do with entropy. What it says is that in any closed system, entropy is the state of disorder in a system. In any closed system, entropy will increase. In other words, it will all start to fall apart. And you find that in any natural system, in an environmental system, in any physical built system, even our own bodies, it's true. Okay. And it would be true in socialism. So a socialist society would be subject to the law of entropy. Things start to fall apart. And what would that look like? It would start to look like people becoming jobs workers, people being eminent, having this sort of eminence-based institutional thinking, people just getting lazy, people getting tired, people doing the same thing out of habit, not because it's the best thing to do, just because they're used to it, people not being interested in innovation anymore, people not being prepared to retool factories, even though someone's invented a better way to do something, they just can't be asked because it's too much work. These are the signs of entropy in a socialist system. Remember what I said about the law of entropy means in any closed system, this is true. Now, in socialist society, it's not a closed system. Why not? Because it's got a natural turnover of population. So you've got new young people always coming in with fresh ideas, they will break up the entropy. They will start, they will rebuild over old stuff. They will put new ideas over old stuff all the time. They will come in and they will say, get rid of that system, that's shit, that's out of date, that's obsolete. If you need to retool, then retool, let's do it. They're the ones who are going to keep pushing and pushing and prevent that society from aging, from going stale, from decaying. That is your dynamic in socialism, and that's what the literature will be about, I think.
Thank you.
Dick? Yeah, I mean, very similar to what I think Paddy was going to say. I'd just like to kind of just take it in a slightly different direction, to say that any kind of socialist society is not a utopia in the sense of a completed system. It's not a sort of final state that we will reach, and therefore that there is nothing further to achieve. So like with any society, I mean, with any form of literature, if you go to any kind of class on the novel, what you will find is that the novel is about conflict. If you haven't got conflict, you haven't got a novel, because nobody's going to read it, because it's dull and it's boring. I see there plenty of conflict in the socialist society, a lot of what Paddy has actually been saying. So a great deal to write about, you know, about as a developing form of society, new institutions will come and go, there'll be experiments, they'll fail, we'll try something else, and people's response to them as well, you know, have the effects on people. So there'll be tons and tons to write about, I think. I don't think there's going to be any shortage of that. I was going to ask you a question as well. But before that, with my logician's hat on, I couldn't help thinking, what you were talking about is what logicians call the genetic fallacy. The genetic fallacy is assessing a point of view because of where it comes from. Yeah, that is logically fallacious. I mean, it's interesting in literary analysis because you can relate a subject to the social context. If you want to understand more about what was going on in the Soviet Union, then you can actually hold this up against it and you can see a mirror to what's going on. But you don't have to.
Exactly.
Just don't have to.
Yeah.
To say that you must is a genetic fallacy, it's a logical fallacy. Mm. But the question I kind of wanted to ask you is a very simple one, and that is, what do you as a social, well, it's a two-part question, but very, very side by side, what do you as a socialist get out of reading these books, and why should we as socialists read this book as opposed to all the other books we've got on our shelves?
So, again, the first... the second part of the question, for all socialists. This is basically the reason why I chose to present Strugatsky books at the summer school, because I believe it offers an appealing vision of a society. And like I said, there is only a small step from visualizing something, from getting into it, to accepting it and to believing that it's possible. So, very often, just because people cannot see it, cannot visualize it, they would think, nah, that's not possible. It's never going to work. Once you show it to them, they're like, okay, maybe there are problems. Okay, well, maybe we can solve these problems. So, again, very small step, but a huge change. And I think this is a great value of these books. That's what they bring. They bring vision of what's possible. For me, it was... very valuable to have read The Dispossessed. Again, as a vision. I haven't imagined something like this before. I don't think this is a good model for a really good socialist society. I think it's on the way there, yes, but it's not really a good depiction of a good socialist society. But it was tremendously helpful just for me personally to visualize it and think, okay, so that would work like this, it's logical, it's coherent, there is some kind of system, there are problems, we can work on it, but at least it shows you something that you can visualize. So for me, Strugatsky books are even better at it, because they present it at the stage where it's already reached, where we are already there. well, we have done so, and many of the things they don't explain, like I was telling Carla, so you have to kind of infer, but at the same time, you see the society as it is, not just as a utopia society where you just have a beautiful life and you don't know where this is coming from. But there are actually clues in the books that give you hints how it's built. So if you just keep thinking, and you start thinking, I think it's quite intelligently written in the way that the society depicted is not, you know, a figment of imagination. It's actually logically coherent. So that's what it gave me personally as a socialist. And also, it's just a feeling. You know, sometimes when you live in a capitalist society, you're so in it that you cannot imagine how does it feel to be in a different world. And once you read these books more and more and more, you start feeling like, I don't know, after reading The Dispossessed, I would, you know, curse at somebody, say, you bloody proprietarian. Well, this is what happens when you read Strugatsky books. You feel like a socialist more. And that's what it gave me personally as a socialist. Like, I already live there when I'm reading it.
Norma?
Just going to add to that, yeah, I think for me when I read books like that, it's sort of empowering, you get a sort of sense of belonging as well,
Glenn?
Just very briefly, when you set out your talk, Leon, you began with referring to utopia as it could be negative or positive. I'm interested to know, and I don't have the answer at all, but if you think about, I'm quite interested to know why a term such as utopia, which to me seems eminently attractive, is given such a negative outlook, if you like, and also used arguably on occasions as an insult even. So if you were discussing socialism with somebody, they kind of look at you scornfully and they say, oh gosh, that's just utopia, as if you were a complete idiot. On the other hand, the utopia, I believe, could also, is almost a synonym of heaven. So, I know that's a religious word, but it is used in other ways. But if you said to someone something and they said, oh, your view is heavenly, that wouldn't come over the same at all. In fact, it's almost a compliment and something they want, where they want to be. So, I'd just be interested to hear perhaps your thoughts as to why something we ideally we'd all like to be in, even if it's progressing and not a steady state of affairs, why is that given such a negative viewpoint? Do you see what I'm saying?
I completely understand. I have to also explain that for me, English is not my first language. So I'm not...
Russian's not my second.
I'm not completely fluent in English. So when I hear the word utopia, at first, to me it was just a literary term. That's how I perceived it. I didn't even know that this is how people in English perceive the word utopia. Now, during that first day of the summer school yesterday, I heard people talking about it and I understood, so that's how people perceive utopia in English. I didn't know. So maybe I'm the wrong person to ask. But I totally agree. But then again, isn't it the same with the word socialism?
Can be.
For us, it's you know, something that we believe in. You tell it to some Trumpist. You know, has anyone heard the song "Cause You're a Socialist"? It's just very funny.
Sing it.
it's a bard, American bard, but basically describing all these things that we kind of take for granted, like the postal office or the libraries, and say, you know, saying things like, do you go to a library? Of course you do, because you're a socialist. So it's like an insult to them, but it's similar in a way, I think, to utopia.
I'll be getting a few hits on YouTube after.
Can I just sentence? I mean, when Thomas More first invented the word utopia for his book, it was a play on words. It's the double entendre. It actually means good place, but it also means non-place, something that doesn't exist, something to be aspired to. So, you know, it has that kind of tension in it, which is kind of really kind of interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Samuel Butler's Error one.
Sorry?
That Samuel Butler's Error one.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but at least he gave us the opportunity to spell it backwards, didn't he? Yeah.
Like Dylan Thomas?
Not so well up with Dylan Thomas, but...
Well, they're all right,
yeah. I have to avoid the word burrow here. Yeah. So, anyone else to ask some questions? So, I think we've had some utopias in this country, haven't worked, haven't we? At Lanark? When it was,
Lanark Heritage Village.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was. It's actually a very interesting place to visit. Owens, Owen Top, Owen James,
Robert
Owens, cheers, thanks. And it was his idea of what he felt would be a utopia and how he wanted to bring his workers up to a reasonable standard of living. Obviously, to get the best out of his workers. But he gave them at the time what was like luxurious accommodation and. You know, based on the philosophy as a socialist, with a critical point of view, you know, a contented workforce is a productive workforce, and sure enough, his production facilities out in this village, it was a woolen mill producing garments and carpets and all sorts of things. From a very young age, although I think he was instrumental in reducing the age of children, or increasing the age of children's welfare and working age. And it was deemed to be a success at the time, looking back on it now. Of course, comparable then, it was good compared to what people were living through. Relatively luxurious by some standards. But looking back at it now, it's still every bit as profound. But it's well, I couldn't really do any justice now. It's been years since I've been there. But if anyone is in that part of the world, it's worth looking up and certainly checking out. As with both things on YouTube, you'll get a lot of detailed history about it there. Yeah, pretty good.
Gentlemen. This gentleman here, and then not you afterwards, okay?
Kevin, Mike on Discord just put his computer in as well, whenever.
Oh, yeah, sorry, go on. Yeah.
To pick up this idea that appears in this, that you're referring to in the Strugatsky books, which I haven't heard them before, so I'm grateful to you for letting us know about them. But this idea of the idea you refer to one utopia as having an elite in there somewhere, and you were saying that the Strugatsky others refer to the greys. Which you know, you took to mean maybe people who don't really get interested in the way the society runs, who want to live a quiet life, if you like. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's everybody really, in a way, more or less. You know, we all just want to live our lives. It seems to me that any idea of a vision of socialism has to work with what he calls disparaging of the greys as taken seriously and as not really being looked down. So for example, what I mean is that it's no good having a utopia where you think, well, we're going to think of ourselves as socialists. Well, we're socialists, so we're going to do... I think in the future society, then people will look at it the same way people look at capitalism, which is just normal, it's life. People don't think there's such a thing as capitalism, they think it's the fact of life. You know? Well, I think that's how people will see utopia, will see socialism when it's eventually established. They'll just take it for granted as being the way that things are. And it has to surely accommodate people's apathy and lack of interest and humanity. I mean, you know, the sort of less, you know, by contrast with what you're painting of this picture that you gave, like as a Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, where everybody's lovely and all patting animals and everything. It's like, it's got to accommodate the fact that we're people and that we're horrible to each other, and we have, you know, we're not necessarily well motivated 100% of the time. It's got to work. And I think it would. But any sort of realistic idea of a socialist utopia surely has to accommodate our flawed humanity. You know, and the fact that the less heroic aspects of it.
Did you say you wanted to, Mike? Did you say you wanted something to say, or?
Well, Mike on Discord and then Dougie on Discord are both accusing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whenever it's their turn.
Right.
Is anyone else?
Well, I don't know how to operate the.
No. But they can hear us. So okay. When it's their turn, they can just switch on the speak.
All right.
It's their turn now, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
Right then, Mike. You
want
to ask me? Yeah.
Thanks, sir. It's just a couple of comments and questions. I've never found this process to be a utopia. I read it in the 70s and it was based on what happened in the 60s. I never found that women at the edge of time as a utopia. They were questioning what the present day society was. But a couple of questions. One, I'd like to thank you for the introduction to the those people from Russia. Don't they say the name? But what three books by them would you recommend for somebody who's never heard of them? That's one question. And the other thing is, I can't see this on. I can see it in Discord, but I can't count. How many people are in that room? How many are male and how many are female? Mike Foster, you can tell me that. But I'd just like to keep a record of the party discussion and the breakdown of gender in them. That's just a good question.
There's about just over 30 of us here, and I'm not sure about numbers, but a good mix of people. So, 11 women, I've been told.
Well, that's at the educational level, isn't it?
Well, it's easy to count numbers, I thought. I do it automatically when I'm in eating socialists.
Okay.
Need to come to the next meeting, Mike. Or next summer school.
And what, three books?
Yeah, three books. Sorry, Mike, was it three yeah. book titles you wanted to know?
Is Leon there? I thought he
was there. Yeah.
Well, what three books by those Soviet Union people do you recommend? Somebody's never heard of them.
Well, it depends on whether you want good literature or good introduction to the known universe.
Both, it doesn't really matter.
I mean, I... I suppose that list that I have in the article that I've written for the publication coming with, that will be available to everybody in the summer school.
Yeah, we can put the titles on Discord as well, maybe, so okay. that people tuning to Discord can read the titles on there. Yeah, okay. We'll do that afterwards.
Okay, that's fine. But the question I asked about gender breakdown, is that not going to be answered?
There's seven women and 17 men, but several people have left the room temporarily, I presume. Right at the moment, that's the numbers.
Dougie was next on Discord.
Yeah. Okay.
Dougie?
Yeah, I've not had any of it looked up. I've been doing a test this weekend, but I've tried to get it. I have most of the top of this stuff to it. I just wonder if Zeitgeist was mentioned, you know, in terms of talking about utopias for the future and what we think of them, really. But I mean, I remember reading the Harry Harrison book. I think it was called The Stimulus Steel Rat Gets Drafted. And it was about a world that was capitalist and had wars and poverty. And they sorted out a computer, and the computer sorted out society. And it ended up being common ownership and free access. And of course, the Stimulus Steel Rat didn't like that, so he moved to another world. But I just thought that was quite an interesting take on, you know, sorting out the world's problems or whatever. But I know it's not what we believe, but it was quite an interesting sort of science fiction novel or whatever. Did Zeitgeist get mentioned at all in terms of setting up some sort of free society?
Have we gone with the Spirit of Times?
Yeah. Spirit of Times, so, I'm not sure. Is Zeitgeist the same as the Zeitgeist movement, Zeitgeist?
Yes. Yes.
Because I'm not... I know
that's what I was on about.
They are... Last I heard, they kind of got together with the Venus Project. And so the utopian vision that was offered was actually from the Venus Project. Zeitgeist mostly criticized the existing capitalist society. And the Venus Project was kind of an engineering approach to how to organize society in a most efficient and logical way, which I think is brilliant, but it doesn't take into consideration those other things that I mentioned that are depicted in Strugatsky's books, such as arts and humanities, because they're just as important in having really harmoniously built society. So engineering approach is wonderful. Like, they had these communities that are logically built, so you don't have waste, there's circularity, everything is to fulfill needs of the people, but there's very little about people themselves, how people interact with each other, how they, you know, social structure and this these things.
Sorry, no, I don't want to interrupt.
Please go ahead.
No, actually, that's not quite right.
Thanks for that, yeah.
It's Jacques Fresco.
Yeah.
And if you were to listen to a lot of his interviews, mm-hmm. he talks about art, he talks about literature, he talks about a lot of things that, the, you know, that we're all artists, that we're all creative, and that he does talk about those things. I think we a lot of people only know that because of the architecture, because, oh, he's a futuristic, you know, techno, whatever he is. But he does talk about stuff. And to me, you know, he's a socialist.
I think so. I agree completely. I think he's a socialist. And I agree that he does talk about these things. I'm not sure if he put these things in that vision of a society, as in how would it work? Do you like teach these arts to children, or do you incorporate? So he envisioned it as incorporated in the design of things that people create, mm-hmm. only, I think. As I haven't seen all of the interviews, maybe I just right. I don't know, but yeah, he's a socialist, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm starting to fade actually in this chair. So what was is anyone else want to yeah?
Just quickly, I did ask the West Midlands chapter of Zeitgeist if they wanted to contribute to this weekend, but didn't get replied. So,
I think we've captured one thing, though, about you talking about Venus, the concept of Venus, because, you know, in England we've got women come from Venus and men come from Mars.
Yeah.
So a bit of advantage there, aren't
they?
So, anyone else? The gentleman with a beard? No? Okay. Anyone without a beard who wants to speak? Thought perhaps it might reflect on the rugged trials of philanthropists a little bit. Because Sir Owen was trying to make a better world in himself. And he was against the whole of the system, isn't it? When he was prepared to do work for no extra pay. Because he enjoyed doing the work. And you had people like Nimrod and coming around checking up on him. And you had the, I think the foreman, Crass, well named. And you know, I think that's a bit of, there's quite a bit of socialism in there if you read it through. Don't know if anyone wants to comment on that.
Certainly a must read for anyone that hasn't read it.
Yeah.
Robert Tressel's Ragged Trouser Philanthropist. And it's widely available as an audiobook on YouTube again.
Yeah.
I should have shares on bloody YouTube. It's definitely worth it. It's a good long listen and read. It's definitely worth for any newbies in the room.
I think the party used to have trips there at one time, didn't they? They used to go to well, it was called Mugsbury in the book, but the actual place where they used to go in the they used to call them a Beano, they used to go out for the day. I'm trying to think where it was.
Hastings,
that's right, yeah. They still got the pubs there. Yeah, in the party, used to go there at one time, have a trip to the... No? I'll put that wrong. So anyone coming through on the system there, or are we closing up now?
Well, if there's
somebody
else, or Leon wants to sum up.
Yeah. Do you want a summation, Leon?
Not really. I'm really glad that there was positive reception of this and such interesting questions. So, thank you. It's a real pleasure to talk to an audience like this. I would like to live in socialism with all of you and obviously the rest of the people. And I hope that, some parts, at least, could have been useful. Could be useful to bring forward our own, no matter how many years we've been thinking about socialism. Just, we can always get a little bit closer to socialism. So I hope this has been useful for that as well.
Thank you very much.